Israeli authorities announced a plan to build 930 new settler units on occupied Palestinian land northeast of Jerusalem al-Quds. The Russian foreign minister is warning that Moscow will retaliate any new U.S. sanctions against the country over jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. And an investigation finds that at least 10,000 children in France have fallen victim to church sex abuse since 1950. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Our top story, Israeli authorities have reportedly approved the building of 930 new settler units in the occupied Palestinian land. According to Palestinian media, the new units will be built in an area northeast of Jerusalem al-Quds. All the Israeli settlements built on occupied land are illegal under international law. Several UN resolutions have also called for a halt to those projects. The Tel Aviv regime, however, has pressed ahead with expanding the settlements over the past years. Palestinians are outraged at the projects and regard them as a main hurdle to resolving their decades-long conflict with Israel. In the meantime, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs says that Tel Aviv intends to develop a, quote, special security arrangement with its Persian Gulf Arab allies that share common concerns over Iran. Benny Gantz says that Israel will continue and develop its relations with that arrangement. He, however, declined to specify what such an arrangement would entail. Gantz also said that Israel is going to develop military ties with every country it has established diplomatic relations. A number of Arab countries, including the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, normalized relations with Tel Aviv during the final days of President Donald Trump. Following the deal, Israel and the UAE regimes also proposed to boost their military cooperation. Tehran has again warned against any anti-Iran resolution at the International Atomic Energy Agency on the nuclear deal. The Iranian government spokesman says that any such move would lead to Tehran reconsidering a recent inspection deal with the IAEA. Ali Rabi warned that the Islamic Republic will react proportionally to an anti-Iran measure during the IAEA Board of Governors meeting in Vienna. He noted the inspection deal with the agency is a clear sign of Iran's goodwill and commitment to peaceful nuclear activity. Tehran has time and again said it would comply fully with the nuclear deal once sanctions against it are lifted.
The International Atomic Energy Agency's 35-nation Board of Governors convenes a virtual meeting with reports that Britain, France, and Germany are circulating a draft resolution to criticize Iran for restricting agency access. IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi reached a temporary bilateral understanding with Iran over a week ago, allowing the agency to continue verification work in the country for up to 90 days. Grossi said the understanding was meant to provide a window of opportunity for political talks to get underway amid attempts to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known formally as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. The possibility of a board resolution, however, is further complicating the situation. Grossi appealed for constructive discussions that would preserve the work of the agency.
The inspection work of the IAEA must be preserved. The inspection work of the IAEA should not be put in the middle of a negotiating table as a bargaining chip.
Iran has warned of countermeasures if the board passes the resolution and says it's cooperating with the agency over questions about the presence of uranium particles at two undeclared sites. Grossi reiterated the IAEA would remain impartial, avoid judging intentions or issuing condemnations.
The work and the trust must always exist. And when we have doubts, we ask questions. We are not condemning anybody.
It's still unclear if the board will adopt the Western-backed resolution, but Russia has already made it clear it will oppose it. In a note to other board members, Russia warned that the adoption of the resolution would hugely complicate efforts to revive the nuclear deal and undermine normal cooperation between Iran and the agency. I'm Homa Lizgi in Vienna.
In Afghanistan, government officials say that three media workers have been killed in eastern Nangarhar province. The victims were all women who were shot and killed in separate attacks in the city of Jalalabad. According to local police, they've taken an armed suspect into custody following the incident. The chief of the Nangarhar Police Department says the suspect is a Taliban member and has admitted to carrying out the assaults. The militant group has not commented on the attacks or the arrest of its member. The violence has increased in the war-torn country in recent months, which the government blames on the Taliban. Well, I talked to our Kabul correspondent, Amin Alami, who provided us with an update on the deadly shootings in the Afghan city of Jalalabad.
Unlike expectations from Taliban's return to intra-Afghan talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, insecurity and violence is on the rise on a daily basis across Afghanistan. Eastern part of this country, mainly Jalalabad, the capital city of eastern Afghanistan, is considered as one of the most volatile cities in this country. And working as a journalist in this part of Afghanistan is, of course, itself is a big risk. Three women who are the staff of a local TV in Jalalabad city were shot dead in separate attacks, according to police sources in eastern city of Jalalabad. But the Taliban militant group rejected being involved in this attack. In the meantime, the Afghan government here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, as well as in eastern Jalalabad province, is strongly condemned this incident and blamed the Taliban for launching such attacks as targeting freedom of speech and press freedom in Afghanistan.
Time now for the news review program. Welcome to the News Review. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has released footage of a ballistic missile attack on Saudi's capital, Riyadh. The video shows the launch of the missile dubbed Zulfaqar that targeted King Khalid Airport in the Saudi capital on Saturday. The Yemeni Defense Forces earlier said that the retaliatory attack also featured as many as nine drones against, quote, sensitive spots in Riyadh. The U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition that launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 claimed that they thwarted the missile attack. The years-long Saudi aggression on Yemen, coupled with a blockade, has devastated much of the country's infrastructure and killed tens of thousands of people. Let's get some insight and contribution on this. So joining me will be Saeed Shahabi, activist and West Asia expert in London, and Laith Maarouf, activist and political analyst in Beirut. Well, let's go to London first. Mr. Shahabi, almost 6 years has gone on, and the Saudi-led coalition has failed to defeat a poor country like Yemen. What's responsible for this failure?
Thank you very much. It is clear now that the Saudis and the Emiratis who had waged this aggression on Yemen are not really doing what they were hoping to do. They have been defeated. Well, it is clear that it is a defeat. Definitely, it is not a victory. But, of course, this defeat, for which the Saudis, the Emiratis, of course, unsupported by America and UK, unfortunately, this defeat has come at a cost. Today, we know that the Yemenis are paying hefty price, very heavy price for the aggression. They are facing the most devastating famine in recent memory. They are facing a country which is in ruin. They are also facing uncertain future as the Americans under Mr. Biden are really not sure what to do. They have called for a ceasefire, or, well, not a ceasefire, but to stop They said that they would stop supplying Saudis with arms, but we are not sure whether Mr. Biden will be wholeheartedly for an immediate and unconditional ceasefire to protect the Yemenis and, of course, to provide a face-saving formula for the aggressors. Mm-hmm. So, all in all, it is a devastating war. It is causing military and civilian casualties. It is killing many thousands of people, right. And it is also destabilizing the region. But whether the aggressors are going to gain anything, it is clear that the Yemenis, the poor Yemenis, have dealt a devastating blow to the prestige of the Saudis and the Emiratis, who were trying to expand their regional influence.
Okay. Now let's turn to Beirut, to your Life, Maruf. Good to have you with us on the show. Life, how much longer do you anticipate this unequal war to go on, given the fact that the Saudis and their allies have not achieved any of their goals?
Well, as long as the Yemeni people are resisting, the Saudis and their coalition and their masters in D.C. will continue this war on Yemen. The ultimate goal for Saudi Arabia and the United States and Israel is to control the Bab al-Mandeb Strait and to make sure that they can choke out any trade in the world from those who they don't like China, Iran, and Russia, and so forth, that goes through that strait. Ultimately, as long as the Yemeni people do not surrender, and they will not surrender because they are trying to liberate their own country, this war will continue, and hopefully the Saudis will be defeated very soon.
Now, let me go back to London and ask Mr. Shahabi. Mr. Shahabi, what do you think is the best way for the Yemenis to continue? Is it best for them to continue resistance? Because they're getting stronger and stronger day after day, and they're hitting targets. So we have the video. We got proof for that, and Saudi's denying this. Is it better for them to go on with this or stop and have somebody like international organizations as a mediator?
Look, do they have a choice? I don't think the Yemenis have a choice but to resist. They have stood fast for the past 6 years. They have proven to the world that money alone and mercenaries alone cannot win a war. If they have proven that people, even if they are poor, if they don't have money, they don't have enough food, they can still resist those arrogant powers, arrogant dictators. They have also proven that American Western supplied armament, despite their advanced technology, cannot really bring proud people to their knees. The Yemenis have proven without and beyond any reasonable doubt they can withstand. What can they do now? They can only stay their foot, stay where they are, and they have already tilted the balance in their favor. They are reacting in a similar way to what the Saudis are doing. So I think it is clear to everybody that the Saudis cannot win the war, the Emiratis have lost the war, and that the only way forward is for the Yemenis to declare victory.
Now back to Beirut, to Life. As you might know, there has been this donor conference organized by the United Nations. And because the UN was warning that a large portion of the Yemeni population would go hungry this year, they asked for a certain amount of money as donation. Only half of that money is going to go to the Yemenis, hopefully. What's the international community doing? Is Yemen a forgotten land? Is not part of human beings, part of the countries on the planet?
Well, basically, anybody who is not part of the West is not considered human beings in this world, and you know that designation requires a person to liberate themselves from imperial order. And in this situation, we saw this UN conference begging for money for the Yemeni people so they don't starve, when in reality there is billions of dollars of Yemeni money that is being looted by the Saudis through the resources of oil and gas that are being ripped apart from the country and smuggled out. And we know that the Yemeni government had billions of dollars outside the country, and those have been looted also by the Saudis and their puppet regime that's residing in Riyadh. So the issue is not that Yemenis are poor. The issue is not that the world doesn't have money to pay for the destruction. Really, they don't want to save enough of the Yemenis or give them enough food that they can resist even more so. Look at how they are resisting under the starvation, and the West knows that it doesn't want to feed them to resist more.
Okay, appreciate your contribution and insight. We had the Saeed Chahabi, activist and West Asia expert from London, and Laith Maarouf, activist and political analyst, who joined us from Beirut. Thank you for staying tuned. The United States has imposed sanctions on 7 Russian officials over the case of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Senior White House officials have been quoted as saying that a U.S. move came after concluding that Moscow was behind last year's poisoning of Navalny. They also said that the sanctions measures were taken in coordination with the European Union. Moscow earlier warned it would reciprocate any new measures. So Moscow has already denied any involvement in the poisoning of the opposition figure, who was rushed to Berlin after falling ill on a domestic flight. Navalny was arrested in January after his return from Germany is sentenced to over 2 years in prison over a 2014 parole violation. Now, an investigation has revised up more than threefold the estimate of the number of kids who fell victim to sex abuse in the French Catholic Church since 1950. It's now saying that the figure could be as high as 10,000. The head of the Independent Inquiry into Sexual Abuse in the French Church says that the commission's previous projection of 3,000 victims had been certainly an underestimate. Jean-Marc Sauve earlier said that 1,500 clergy and church officials sexually abused minors in the past 70 years. The French church has been plagued by such scandals. Last year, a French priest admitted to abusing some 80 boys aged between 7 and 10 over 2 decades while he was a Scout leader. Bernard Prenat said that his superiors then turned a blind eye to his behavior. Germany has announced a decision to extend its COVID-19 lockdown until March 28. The country, however, will ease some of the current restrictions from next week. Chancellor Angela Merkel is set to discuss the easing options with state leaders on Wednesday. Meantime, Germany has reported 358 more COVID deaths, raising the tally to 70,000. Confirmed infections also reached over 2.4 million. Elsewhere in Europe, the Czech government has tightened lockdown measures, deploying 30,000 security personnel to restrict public movement throughout the nation. And in Finland, the government has declared a state of emergency as it's preparing to introduce tougher measures to stem infections. Some European countries have already started a mass vaccination program. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the lighter side of the news. It's good to have you with us. Well, this looks good. Tourism in Oman took a nosedive during the COVID-19 pandemic, sadly, much like many places in the world. But one village managed to turn its fortunes around by transforming some ancient homes into hotels and touristic attractions. Nestled in the high mountains of Oman, the village of Misfat al-Ibrahim offers some of the most beautiful and serene natural areas for trail running and rock climbing. Now the village has repurposed ancient mud brick homes into boutique hotels. The beige-coloured homes with walls of handmade mud brick are elegant and simple. And the interior spaces are furnished with traditional wood and textiles.
Misfat al-Ibrahim attracts many tourists, so people and project owners in the village have planned on expanding touristic projects. You'll find heritage hotels, popular cafes and restaurants. We as a company decided to provide various adventure-related activities too.
The centuries-old homes were renovated for safety and comfort to combine old Omani life with modern amenities. The village is near what is called Oman's Grand Canyon and has somewhere around 800 residents. Many tourists have visited the area because of the heritage hotels and environmental components in the ancient village. These inns have attracted many tourists to the area despite the COVID-19 pandemic. Almost everyone has seen snowmen, but how many people have encountered a snow snake in their lifetime? A family in the US has awed their neighborhood with a fascinating ice sculpture of a serpent. The household in Colorado spent 10 hours making the impressive artwork in their front yard. They first created the shape of the animal and then sprayed paint on it to bring it to life. The sculpture measures 23 meters in length. It has attracted many neighbors and passers-by who occasionally take pictures with it. This is not the first time the family made headlines with their ice work. In 2019, they caught people's eyes with an ice sculpture of a tiger. A giant ice disc with an even greater message here. People in Finland have carved a humongous carousel in Lake Lapajärvi to raise awareness about global warming. An inventor and a team of helpers spent days in sub-zero temperatures to create what they say is the world's largest ice carousel. The rotating machine is over 300 meters wide and is spun by motorboats. The makers also carved another smaller disc in the ice next to it. The two carousels were commissioned by local authorities who want to bring attention to climate change and shortening winters in Finland. An iceberg the size of Greater London breaks off in Antarctica years after the first cracks appeared. The iceberg detached from the Brunt ice shelf near a British research station and is expected to either move away or run aground not far from the ice shelf. Scientists were expecting the calving of the iceberg to happen after monitoring the area with GPS instruments and satellite imagery on a daily basis. They discovered the first cracks almost 10 years ago, but they are skeptical about the role of climate change in this case.
A unique remnant of bygone days. Archaeologists have found a rare ancient Roman ceremonial carriage outside Pompeii. The carriage was unearthed near the stables of a village just outside the very city. It has four wheels and is made of iron, bronze, and tin. The vehicle is the first of its kind discovered in the area. Italy's culture minister has called it a unique find without any precedent in the country. Pompeii was buried under ash and a volcanic eruption in 79 AD. So far, about two-thirds of the ancient city has been uncovered, I should say. the lights, merriment, and traditional food. That's what China's Lantern Festival has brought to millions of people across the country.
Loneliness can hit anyone at any time, but it becomes severe during the pandemic-like scenario the world is going through. But some Japanese are enjoying the companionship of robots to overcome loneliness as they are unable to meet their loved ones during the coronavirus. The cute singing snowman is called Charlie. He is one among a large number of new generation clever robots being produced in Japan. Manufacturers are making a wide variety of affordable androids as well as robotic pets, and they say their sales are booming. They also say their products have found favor with customers of all ages, not just kids. Studies have shown that therapeutic pets can bring comfort to dementia patients.
Spring is coming, and blossoming flowers are once again creating stunning sceneries across China. Clouds of cherry blossoms have created breathtaking views in Wuhan, a city known for being the birthplace of COVID-19. Inside the city, the main university is one of the best places to enjoy those blossoms, being well known for that among the Chinese. Students are thrilled to enjoy the floral scenery after missing it last year.
As the pandemic has been well brought under control in China so far this year, residents in Wuhan City, as well as students, workers, and teachers of the university all come for the flowers and this warm spring.
In other cities, it is the plum flower that attracts a large number of visitors. They say the white-colored blossoms on mountains seem as if it had been snowing. Many of the tourists choose to stay in resorts that offer picturesque views of flowers. Many say they wait for a year so that they can draw a picture of the blossoms.
Police across the globe are using new methods to prevent crime and improve their performance. Now, Pakistani police have come up with an idea to put officers on rollerblades to catch criminals in the commercial hub Karachi. The new armed rollerblading unit is going through rigorous training for over a month with the aim of curbing theft and harassment on the streets. During the training, they were seen carefully balancing on skates while leaping over staircases or lifting their guns. The unit, made up of 10 men and 10 women, would be sent to public places. The chief of the unit says rollerblades make chasing thieves on motorcycles through the city of 20 million much easier.
We felt we needed to come up with some innovative approach to control street crime in Karachi. We analyzed and saw that there are certain spots where crime incidents, say for example mobile snatching, are more frequent. We also saw that criminals use motorcycles that help them run away easily. At times, it is difficult for police teams to chase them from our vehicles.
The unit chief also says that officers would only carry handguns, while in some locations, such as shopping malls, they will not be armed at all. Officers say they can now reach narrow alleys very quickly, where it's usually difficult to go. The rollerblading police are expected to be deployed officially next month.
The coronavirus and related restrictions have forced many businesses to either close or struggle. But some people have found ways to save their jobs and help others to survive the crisis. A top German chef is the one. Peter Frusammer now prepares dishes at a hospital canteen outside Berlin. Frusammer says before accepting the job, he was the head chef at his wife's restaurant. But it was closed due to the pandemic, and he chose to be a hospital cook rather than a jobless man. This German chef says he is happy to find some distraction while working in a hospital kitchen, besides making a contribution to patients' recovery.
I find it frustrating to be here and see the empty tables and the empty restaurant. When I'm at the hospital, I don't notice any of this. For me, the coronavirus crisis doesn't exist at the hospital. Sure, corona is always a topic, but there, I'm at work and I'm busy. But when I come here, I notice what a cut is going through society. That's why I'm happy to have my hospital and to find some distraction. Here in the restaurant, I could actually sit down and start crying.
The hospital staff also seem happy with Frusammer's presence. They say since the arrival of the new chef, they come to eat in the canteen regularly and discover new dishes not eaten before. Firooz Amer believes the reason health workers and patients love his dishes is that he gives his heart and soul to the food.
Niagara Falls on the US-Canada borders is known for its spectacular timeless beauty, attracting tourists, especially during the summer. But this year's frigid temperature has created another spectacular scene at this natural wonder. Visitors to the New York side of the falls were treated with a remarkable view as stream falling down the Niagara River is now crusted with ice. A rainbow adds more beauty, leading to the most amazing view of the falls. Every day, dozens of people help each other walk across icy stream to take a closer look at the beauty created by the extreme cold weather. More snowfall, low temperature have been predicted for the coming days, meaning people will have more time to enjoy the place.
For some people, it may take years to build a morning running habit. However, this very special runner seems very impatient in sticking to its daily running routine. The 2-meter tall ostrich escaped its dwelling to run alongside vehicles on the streets of Beihai, South China. It even tried to keep up with a car's speed by jogging at a very fast pace. The bird's owner says it opened the gates of the farm it stayed in and escaped. He guided the fugitive bird back to the farm by covering his face with a red cloth. The video of the athlete ostrich went viral after its running was caught on traffic cameras. That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing US Election Day documentary 11-8-16, produced and created by Jeff Deutschman. And joining me in the studio, we have Anna Smith, who is a film critic and broadcaster. She is also the president of the UK Critics Circle and a regular film critic for various mainstream channels. And beside her, we are also joined by Jonathan Fryer, who is a lecturer, broadcaster and freelance writer. Now, on the 8th of November 2016, Americans from all walks of life went to the ballot box to vote for their next president, though little did they know at the time what would be in store for them, after most people believed that the country would be seeing its first female president be elected. This documentary, which features the work of many directors and film crews, follows a cross-section of Americans throughout that fateful day and shows the complex and diverse spectrum of opinions about their reasons for voting for Trump or for Clinton, or in some cases, not voting at all.
Days to election, I can update this.
Did you vote today?
I voted early.
You did?
Friday.
Did it feel great?
Today, I'm going to vote for the first time in over 30 years.
Good morning, gentlemen.
I'm a little nervous about the outcome of the election, the future for the coal industry.
You can't stop doing politics. Knock on doors, say, hey, excuse me, did you vote today? Be polite. It's a beautiful day.
The election will be over by 9 o'clock. They'll call it by 9:30, and everything will be peaceful and wonderful.
What if it goes the other way?
What? Not going to go the other way. No way. Mark it down.
Thank you.
I could feel eyes watching me as I walked through that crowd, like they hated me, like I was Donald Trump.
They say, you know, your vote may make a difference, but to me, I don't think so.
हम रहते हैं इस कंट्री में, कमा के हम खाना खाते हैं, पीछे अपने फैमिली की टेक केयर करते हैं, तो आई प्रे अमेरिका लिव लॉन्ग एंड प्रॉस्पर.
It looks like maybe we should be planning for the too close to call scenario or the Trump win. God shed his grace
on me. Out of who we had as president, African Americans were still the lowest man on the totem pole. See to
shine. There's hope. Never forget that the power of the people is stronger than the people in power.
from sea to shining sea.
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for both of you for coming on. Now, this documentary could be seen as quite a historic and invaluable piece of filmmaking, as it gives the world viewers an insight, a sort of a window into the psyche of Americans voting that day and what they were thinking. And Anna, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you're right that it's an interesting snapshot of Americans, and it also has an emotive subject, a fascinating subject, which all great documentaries need. And what all great documentaries need as well is great characters. And this has lots of really strong characters, people who are voting from different sides, who strongly believe in what they're talking about, and the access to them on a day that is a very important day in their lives means that there's some explosive conversations and some very telling and revealing conversations. So broadly, I liked it.
That's a great opinion. And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna just said?
Yes, I mean, the technique of the documentary was really interesting. The producers called it a periscope view, with 16 periscopes popping up across all the way from New York over to Hawaii, even interviewing different families and individuals. And of course, it's fascinating because watching it, we know the outcome. But during the film itself, until right at the end, the actual voters are not aware of the outcome. But many of them are really, really engaged, as they either want Hillary Clinton to win, as what was expected originally, or they're rooting for Trump. And it's fascinating to see how their mood changes, in some cases optimistically, in other way, in for other people, disastrously, as they see exactly what they didn't want to happen and literally are brought to tears.
And the dramatic irony of it, actually, is what makes the film so fascinating and relevant today to watch, actually. And I just want to talk about Jeff Dutchman's previous work. He made a similar film about Obama's election campaign and his supporters. And I bet we can imagine that probably had a different tone than compared to this film. What do you think, Anna?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very different, because of course it's fascinating. He goes about these films without knowing the outcome. But obviously people were much more optimistic about Obama winning, and this was a bit of a surprise result in this case. So it's fascinating to think that when he and all the directors involved, because he sort of curated this, and there were
and
all the other directors.
And what a feat for filmmaking, actually. I wonder how difficult that must have been to coordinate.
Yeah, he sourced a lot of great filmmakers from all over the world who were very talented, and obviously a lot of them probably had a connection with their subjects, which gave rise to some very, very interesting people and subjects. But yeah, I mean, it just watching it in retrospect then makes it particularly interesting, of course, because there is this sense of perhaps impending doom or success, depending on your point of view, that you just know is going to be a real shock to some people that you're watching. So it adds to the tension.
It was a great collaborative project indeed. And Jonathan, just quickly before we move on, if you could just take us back to that time, why was it so shocking for Trump to win? And in hindsight, is it actually that surprising?
He was an extraordinary candidate and, of course, had become now a very extraordinary president, because he was absolutely not the normal run-of-the-mill politician, basically. He was anti-politician. And so it was an enormous shock when he was elected. And everyone did expect, most people expected, Hillary Clinton would win. And I'm sure the director was thinking, right, but it didn't happen.
And it was much to everyone's surprise, actually.
So you are in the vast majority of the populace that does not vote. How are you feeling about that?
I feel pretty good. More than we are voting for any particular candidate, we are voting for the system. And it is a system that I just don't abide by. We don't need new legislation. We don't need a new politician. We don't need the Constitution to change to actually, like, care for our community. You just have to have the will. That's where I put my effort. I put my effort there because I think change comes from the work that we do, not from the ballot box.
My white people have always had the right to vote, right? Like, my lineage has always been, we've been the power, right? So what would you say to somebody who would be like, wait a minute, you're African American?
You mean like my grandmother?
Yeah, like your grandmother.
As much as I really honor the nothing less than heroics that it took in order for African Americans to be able to vote, you know, getting the right to vote was the equivalent of walking into a room, a game of Monopoly was being played by all rich white men. The game was already in motion, property was already bought, hotels already built, and African Americans earned a right to sit at the table. They earned a right to sit at the table, start in jail, didn't collect $200, start off with no money, no property, nothing. That's a game you cannot win. It's about time that we walk in and wipe the whole damn game off the table and start over.
I think one of the most prominent issues this documentary exposes is the clear racial division in the US. Thinking back to the scene where we see in Chicago African Americans talking amongst themselves sort of the conflict they feel in having to choose between Trump or Clinton, and they say that Clinton obviously isn't the great candidate for them either, considering the whole super predator count scandal and the three strikes you're out sort of thing, and then Trump isn't so great on minorities either. Anna, could you just tell us, did this documentary, was it effective in exposing this racial divide and how complicated this issue is?
I think you're right, it is an extremely complicated issue, and it's very hard in the space of a documentary like this, especially with so many different people and so many different directors, to really get to the heart of the issue. But at the same time, it did touch on a lot of that, and it was very careful, I think, to have a variety of people from different sides and of different races talking about how they felt about it. And I thought the filmmakers succeeded in getting people to be very frank about racial issues, as we saw just there, and very articulate. So it was thought-provoking for me on that level.
And Jonathan, would you agree? Do you think this documentary exposed
the divided nation? Well, I think it really stressed the diversity rather than the division, the diversity of the American population. People have been there for generations, some who are very new immigrants. It's interesting, it starts with a Sikh taxi driver who is clearly from a Punjabi family who've probably very recent immigrants and rather excited by the idea that they will be able to vote. So in that sense, I think it's extremely valuable in showing the different races, ethnicities, religions, etc., that make up the United States. But without a doubt, some people very clearly in the film felt disenfranchised, even if they were able to vote. It's interesting, it ended with a very poor couple in Hawaii living in a tent in a park who basically sort of say, well, you know, okay, it was election, but what sort of difference is it going to make to our lives? Nothing whatsoever.
And I like how it came actually full circle to that point, actually, that some people are very helpless when it comes to politics and it doesn't make a difference to them. So I just want to talk about some statistics now. Data from the election actually shows that the majority of young white Americans, both male and female, under 44 years old, voted for Hillary Clinton, whereas those mostly over 45 overwhelmingly voted for Trump. So Jonathan, why do you think Americans voted the way they did?
Well, there clearly was a very stark generational divide. It's rather interesting, we had a very similar phenomenon here in Britain in 2016 with a EU referendum of which 45 and over majority voted to leave the EU, 44 and younger voted to stay. So there clearly is something happening between the different generations. But what was really also very interesting about the statistics in the US election was that people outside the cities voted for Trump. It was sort of like a rural revolution of people, particularly older people who maybe had seen their hopes dashed for a brighter future and were therefore determined to go out and to make a protest, basically.
Well, we're lucky to have Jonathan here to give us political context to this. I was just quickly wondering, Anna, would you have liked for more political context to these stories?
I think it's also well publicised now that even the most casual observer of the news will know exactly what happened on that day and what the results were and what the ramifications would go on to be for the people that we see on camera. I found it interesting as someone that doesn't necessarily follow every inch of the political news to find out who, you know, the sort of makeup of the voters and the characters of the voters, because, and particularly the Trump voters, because you hear a lot about and see a lot about Trump himself, but to see who actually voted for him and then giving the reasons why, I found fascinating.
And of course, we actually learned that a lot of people who voted for Trump were scared to admit they voted for Trump, so it was only in the aftermath that we really found what was actually happening. I'm glad we've got to see the sort of behind the scenes of the media rooms and them preparing for the election result. And they largely believed Clinton was going to win. Anna, what could we learn from the documentary about the role media or social media played in the election?
It was fascinating, wasn't it, that they felt that they kind of knew. I mean, they prepared for every scenario, but there was that confidence in the polls, which evidently was misplaced. So I think a lot of journalists could probably learn from that scenario, from watching that. I certainly found it fascinating watching those journalists there sort of hedging their bets, but basically thinking that Hillary was going to win. In terms of the media, in terms of people from all walks of life making assumptions based on what they see and hear. And also when you see people in this documentary watching the results come on screen, on their own TV screens, you just see how sheltered some of those people are on both sides and how little they understand about other people's opinions and how we become, you know, even in social media, we only really follow people with a similar point of view, which isn't, social media is not really explored in this, but I think that's something that is a spring, sort of springboard for thinking about that.
Definitely. It raises many questions, actually. And Jonathan, if I could put that question to you, what role do you think, actually, the media, indeed social media, played on the election?
Well, there are two different things, the mainstream media and the social media. The mainstream media, it was clear that most of them, with exceptions such as Fox News, were rooting for Hillary Clinton and firmly expected her to win, though obviously they had to make provision for a result of a different kind. Social media was an entirely different matter because there, the Trumpers, if we can call them that, were really in the ascendant. And this is the first presidential election in the United States where social media had a huge impact. I mean, Donald Trump himself has millions of followers, and whereas many people may say a lot of what he tweets about on Twitter is rubbish or untrue, it has a huge effect, and he has that great following. And he, of course, despises the mainstream media, talks about fake news, because the liberal commentators on the LA Times and other newspapers, of course, are opposed to the sorts of things that he believes in and propagates.
And why is it that so many people could believe this, though, that he could label the news, certain news channels fake news, and he was so hostile to the press?
Well, we've come into what's called the post-truth world, where it's no longer, you know, what is true that you necessarily accept, but it's what you believe is truth. In other words, if it fits in with your own prejudices and your own approach, then that's fine. That's the news, and that's what you're going to put forward.
And so there's so many interesting questions then that this documentary could raise. Do you think there's any other points and strong themes that this documentary had?
Well, I felt like it could have gone further. It could have shown more Trump supporters, as I said. It could have been more revealing. But in terms of the points it made, for me, characters are such a huge part of it. And to see the dynamic, particularly between one of the husband and wife in Massachusetts, and she's a little bit more reserved about Trump and he's really gung-ho, and to see the difference between families and couples and generations and how they interpret politics and speak to each other about politics, I thought was really, really interesting.
And that's an interesting point, actually, not to defend Trump supporters, but you realise that they're human beings and not all of them are evil, but they have different motivations and grievances for voting in terms of the whole system and their fight, especially when it comes to finances, I think, in the documentary.
A lot of times I work a long day. I'm out of the house before my kids even get out of bed. And then when I come home, it's 6 o'clock at night, it's dark, you know, it's time to eat dinner and go to bed, basically. So if the economy got better and I was bringing more people and more work into my shop and I could delegate a little bit more, then I'd be able to spend more time with my family. That'd be huge. That would be huge for me. I'm doing okay for myself right now, but it would be even that much better, you know? I don't know. I think if when Hillary gets elected, and I think she's going to get elected because she's going to
cheat.
If she's going to raise the taxes on everybody, and healthcare right now is crushing us anyway, so I'm concerned that we're going to have a tough time making ends meet.
It's not right. And you know Hillary doesn't care about anything but her pockets.
Take that stupid hat off, man.
I will not take this hat off.
What contribution do you think they made to the documentary?
They brought an entertainment factor, I think, which is really important. There's nothing to say that documentaries about political subjects need to be entirely serious. And it was sort of dark humour, but just seeing the dynamic between them was really involving and entertaining. But it also showed, as I said earlier, that you can, within a couple, see different political views and see different strains and strengths, but also what worrying things that people might be influencing each other and perhaps voting is in what they don't personally actually really believe in. They're being swayed.
And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna said?
Yeah, they were a fascinating family, and they raised two issues there in that which are really important. You know, there's tax, because Trump was saying he was going to cut taxes particularly for the higher income earners, which would be attractive to business people. And the other thing was Obamacare. You know, one of the huge things that really figured in the election was the cost of Obamacare. President Obama brought in a system where poor people had medical insurance.
Surely
which
that's
we think
a good
is
thing.
Great, of
Isn't
course.
That akin to
of
the
course,
NHS
but the Trumpers, on the other hand, were saying we're paying for all these people to do that. But very interesting point made by a number of people. during the film is they were voting against someone rather than for someone. And that's why Hillary lost, even though, of course, she actually got more votes than Trump did in the popular vote.
About 2.9%.
But she was more unpopular than Trump was.
Mm-hmm. And does that expose flaws, then, I suppose, in the American voting system?
Well, to us in Britain, which we don't have a flawless system here either, but it does seem really weird that someone can win the popular vote but lose the presidency.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, and I just wanted to talk about the parallels, actually, between the UK and the US and theatrical aspect of the US. I was just wondering, is there a documentary of this sort that would be as fascinating in the UK as it would be to follow an American election? Do you think it would be as interesting?
Well, obviously, Brexit docs are fascinating, aren't they? I mean, that's the closest thing we've had recently. You're right, though, the Americans do have a showy way about them. But goodness, look at reality TV shows in the UK. We've certainly got our fair share of big personalities. So I think good documentaries can always find them.
Yes. Oh, no, that's a good point, actually, indeed, as also that we can compare. And I suppose UK politics seems to be a bit more on the serious side, or perhaps not.
Well, it'd be very interesting. The next election, presumably, we will have Jeremy Corbyn leading the Labour Party into an election campaign, and there'll be a big focus on, is this a man who can be Prime Minister? Is this a man who can lead Labour Party to victory? Because the opinion polls at the moment are saying more or less the Conservatives and Labour equal pegging, which is bizarre when the government is doing things which are frankly difficult to support. Why isn't the opposition miles ahead? So there's a ground for a real mystery there. So perhaps some documentary maker could already be plotting the election coverage documentary of Election Day, whenever it's going to be.
Perhaps. And just going back to the documentary, as we near the end of this discussion now, actually, I just wanted to get, Anna, your final thoughts on this documentary, and also would you recommend it?
I don't think it's an earth-shattering documentary, but I think it's very, very interesting. And I think if you want a further insight into what motivated a lot of American people to place their vote a certain way, then it's well worth a watch.
And Jonathan, if I turn to you, your final thoughts on the film, yeah, would you
when
recommend
it? When it first started, I thought, oh my goodness, we're going to watch this for an hour and 45 minutes, am I going to really be interested? But you do get interested in the characters, in the individual families. In fact, I was disappointed when it finished.
Mm. And we'll have to leave it there on that good note to end it on. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.